Welcome to the Booktopia podcast. I'm John Purcell and I'm joined by Inga Simpson, author of Nest and We Missed the Wig, and a new book, Where the Trees Were. Welcome, Inga.
Hi, John. Thanks for having me.
Now, it's not... I came out pretty strong about Mr. Wig. I was very much in love with that book. And your follow-up, Nest, was absolutely gorgeous, but also surprising. I was expecting your career to go in one direction, you went on another direction, and here again I'm seeing an even more diverse and richer outlook. That is, for me, one of the most exciting things of dealing with an author who will wander, won't be stuck in one kind of... I can't even call it a genre, can I? It's one certain themes, you know what I mean? With this one, how did this come about? It feels like it's been hanging around in your imagination for some time. Would that be right?
It's well spotted. In some ways it has. There are two kind of angles from which I approached it and which ended up being this book. So I had an idea to write an art crime novel. So there's been a lot of reading and thinking about that and maybe how to come up with an Australian version of that. Because those art heists are always about the European masters, the Rembrandt or the Picasso. And the other part is about these the Wiradjuri burial trees. Mm-hmm. And I found out about those a few years ago and had an idea for a plot about how I might write about those. I grew up in Wiradjuri country, so Central West New South Wales, on a property, and I had never heard of these trees. And so in my 40s I found out about these beautiful carved trees called arboglyphs, and they were to signify the graves of significant male elders. And at some point, these two ideas, the art crime and these arboglyphs, of which there were thousands of at settlement, and now there are only one or two left in situ, finally it occurred to me that too was a type of art crime, much more than that, obviously, because mm-hmm. these were sacred sites, culturally, spiritually, very sensitive, and just removed without much thought by settlers and farmers since. So, I had these two ideas. And I wanted a group of young people to come across some of these trees and, sense their significance and have good intentions for saving them, but perhaps it didn't turn out as they planned. So, in a way I had the germs of it in the back of my mind for a long time. And so when they came together and had a bit of their own chemistry, if you like, something else came out, but, the gist of it.
Are you okay with me talking about it in those times where I saw these very different novels coming from the one author?
Yeah.
Because an art heist novel and Nest was with that undercurrent of a really horrible crime and Mr. Wig being about, I suppose, the life journey, the value of life and the passage of life. There's so many different themes that go in there. For an author to strike out in those different directions so early in the writing career, for me it seems in this market it seems courageous, but it's working. So
thank you. I'm flattered by that. I'm not someone who wants to just churn out the same thing over and over again. But in a way, a lot of the same concerns are there in all of them. Yeah. Nature, setting, place, they're important to all of them. So I feel like the similarities I'm fairly exposed with them. But I like to challenge myself each time. And with this one, I had the idea for a plot came to me. Plot doesn't come that easily necessarily to me.
Does that mixing moment, was that a eureka moment where you went, oh, that makes sense, now I can put this in
there? I'm like, oh, I have an idea for a plot instead of I have a character or I have a place that I want to write about. I had an idea. I wanted something a bit more plot-driven for my readers, and so in part I'm always responding to some of the feedback I get on the previous book too. There are people who absolutely love Nest, But and it was just what they were looking for, and they wish there were more books out there like that, and I'm glad that they found one and I found them.
Yeah.
But yeah, I wanted to show that I can do plot, I can do a little bit of action. I also wanted to bring that story of the burial trees to a wider readership. I want people to read this like the adventure story that it kind of is, a kid's coming of age story. Mm-hmm. But I wouldn't mind if people talked about these trees a little too.
For many years when I was trying to be a writer and thinking about writing and planning, I had an absolute aversion to the idea of plot and plot-based things. And
yeah.
I wrote many failed novels because there wasn't any structure or plot to it. And then a friend of mine who pointed out that all my favourite books were very heavily plot-based, but you just didn't see the plot. It was buried.
Yeah.
The Thomas Hardy plot rises every once in a while, and the Jane Austen is so seamless that you sort of feel that there's all these other things going on, but you're going on with the plot. So it was one of those moments where I just sort of slapped my forehead and went, here I have been damning the idea of a plot when all my favourite writers have very successfully made use of it. Was that something that, I suppose with literary authors there is that kind of aversion to a straight plot-based novel. Was that something, when you teach writing, you talk about writing a lot, was that something that you had to learn yourself, that it is sort of okay to kind of...
Yeah, I think so. I think there's been a process of adjustment, or similar to what you described, realising that actually, you know, you do need something pulling the reader through, the less visible it is, sure.
Yeah.
I probably focus too much on style, you know.
Yeah.
I'm not sorry, but I have learned a little as I've come along, and you learn that teaching too, that maybe I'm focusing too much. You know, when I'm mentoring a writer, I'm picking up all this style of stuff, when really there's a really good story there, they've just got a different style.
Yeah.
And for me, each book has had a slightly different style, so leaving a bit of space for each project to take a different form and have a slightly different style. I also wanted to try Mr. Wig and Nest. Both those stories, a lot of the main plot, or the main character development, is Todd's backstory. So I was conscious that that was a thing that I did.
Yeah.
I had to kind of fill in as backstory their emotional paths and in their relationships in particular. So I thought it was high time I actually put my character in a current relationship.
I must say that both those efforts were very successful in getting across that character. But those books were gorgeous in that light, you know, with those drops in. I saw something the other day, a bit of Franzen talking about purity, and he was saying that the plot was his way in a sense, to drag people where he wanted them to go, where they might not necessarily go otherwise, and to bring issues and stories and things which can't be, probably wouldn't reach the wider audience if he didn't drive it, you know, drive them to the end of the book with a strong plot.
Yeah, I think that's really well explained, and it probably applies to this, where there is kind of a, you know, I'm making a comment about a lot of actions of settler Australians, and if I was to tackle that whole issue or to give one of my characters a voice where they were critical of recent history, that wouldn't be necessarily a compelling or an appealing read.
Hmm.
But throw in an artist and some kids stumbling across something and put those two stories together, and I'm hoping exactly as he expressed, that the story drives people along and they're not thinking about it particularly until later, perhaps. And for me, the twin narrative created a lot of, as a writer for process, the twin narratives created some problems to solve, and out of solving those problems is where some of the most interesting material came from for me, yeah.
Right now, at this moment, in Australian fiction, we've had Salt Creek and Rush O, in the non-fiction, talking to my country, there have been, there seems to be a resurgence of interest in the Australian experience and also the Aboriginal experience of Australians arriving in, and the kind of the clash. And interestingly enough, the new Annie Proulx book that's coming, Bark Skins, I think it's called, she spent 5 years writing it, is on the back of the book. I think they might need to change it, because the way they described it was the history of the destruction of trees, I think, as a
the forests.
Yeah,
I'm reading the same book.
Yeah. So it seems like at this moment there seems to be a consciousness of that, and that moment where we're exploring. I mean, in Salt Creek there's an exploration of just how different the experience of the same event, you know, was for these two groups of people. Mm. Is that something that it's part of what's happening now, or is it something that you've always been interested in and it's just risen up and it seems to be bubbling up in different people's creative experience as well?
Yeah, I think there's something bigger going on. For me personally, it's come out of my PhD research. I've been looking at the history of Australian nature writing, and I'm looking at contemporary Australian nature writing too. And one of the biggest issues for Australian nature writers is how to talk about connection to place, you know, against the knowledge of how they came to be in that place, or call themselves the owners of that property, and so it's been a concern of nature writers, you know, for 100 years, and it hasn't really been reconciled or addressed. And you know, Judith Wright raised the same issue in the 60s, and I don't know that we've progressed particularly.
But no.
I get the sense that in literature, just recently, perhaps there is a shift, and from both sides. I mean, I think Melissa Lukashenko's book, Malambimbi, there's a lovely aspect to that where, in the end, there's some common ground between the white settler, farmer, the landholder, and the Indigenous character. And there is some, a tiny bit of reconciliation there. I felt like it was reaching out in that direction,
yeah.
You know, from an Indigenous writer. And I think there are some white writers doing the same thing, trying to explore these things, but trying to do so respectfully, trying to find out how to do that, to be consultative, and use the right language and go through some processes that make that less frightening, or less, that's not the right word. But I think there has been an apprehension about putting in Indigenous character in our books, or incorporating a story like this with the destruction of burial trees, incorporating an Indigenous storyline.
Yeah.
Even though these are the very aspects of our history that we need to be talking about, perhaps there has been a bit of apprehension. So if a few writers take it on and, you know, it opens up some discussion, then it makes it easier for the writers that follow, I guess.
Do you think that having been raised in the country and not hearing these stories through that year, and then coming through those years and then coming in your 40s to start hearing about this, is that a kind of, there's a moment where you feel that you have to redress that use of that land for that long, and having absolutely no concept in your younger years of what all that meant?
Yeah, absolutely. At school, it was never mentioned. You know, we never learnt that it was even Wiradjuri country.
Yeah.
You know, I only heard that in my 30s. We studied history, no mention of, there was only settler history. There was nothing prior to settler history. There was no, where I grew up was quite close to the Bathurst Wars, which were, you know, it was martial law was declared. It was a massive event, massacres of real significance, terrible significance, never mentioned, still barely mentioned, you know, in any books. So yeah, I was ashamed to not know about these trees, to find out that there'd been some quite close to where I grew up. Probably I'd passed them in the car many times. Didn't know, wouldn't have known of their significance if I had seen them. Trying to rewrite my childhood, perhaps, you know, to give those children that knowledge and that, and a different experience, you know, what more, a wiser experience, yeah.
Well, I've been a great advocate through Booktopia of your work, and I will continue to be an advocate, and I look forward to seeing what new directions you take. You did mention, out as we were signing some copies of the book, some news. I don't know whether you can share that, your next step with us, or...
No, I can. My next book is a non-fiction book, so it's a work of nature writing. Not sure of the title, but it'll be out in July next year, I think. And it's about the place where I live now, on the Sunshine Coast hinterland. My kind of journey of moving, doing the tree change, moving to a property, living among trees. A little bit about my writing journey as well. And some of the literature that has led me down the sort of nature writing path and contributed to my publication story as well, yeah.
Well, I'm holding a copy now, and it has a very nice shiny gold sticker on the front, a great read from Women's Weekly. That will ensure some mega sales for you, which I'm very pleased about, because I want everyone to know about your writing and your past books and to be ready for your new book from next year, is it?
I think. Yeah.
Yeah. Where the Trees Were is available from booktopia.com.au right now. Thank you very much, Inga, for coming in and talking to us.
No, thanks, John. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for listening to the Booktopia podcast. And don't forget to subscribe to us on SoundCloud and iTunes. And if your eyeballs need a workout, check us out on YouTube at Booktopia TV. And don't forget, for all books featured on this episode and all episodes of the Booktopia podcast, head to Booktopia, Australia's local bookstore, at www.booktopia.com.au. Thanks for listening.